Greetings from K9 to Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum, Diddly-Dum. End of message.
Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 141 of the Diddly Dum podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
You find us today not as normal in the Whoseum, but a few miles down the road on the coast of Somerset. We're in the Maiden's Head Lighthouse. Up in the lamp room, with our microphones and recording equipment set up. And isn't it a wonderful view, chaps?
It's a bit foggy.
Oh yes, I think that's come from Iceland or somewhere.
Oh, we'd never seen a fog like this before.
So what has been happening of late? I know that Hayden and Sophie's baby has started kicking in the last week, hasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, hopefully within the next week or two we'll be able to work on catching and heading as well.
He's probably thinking, oh God, he's a podcaster.
Oh, don't worry, there'll be plenty of time for he or she to be disappointed with me in the future, so it's all good.
And you've been treading the airways, haven't you?
I have, yeah, on Fab International Radio. I was interviewed by Martin Holmes for the Vision on Sound programme. Martin does a podcast with Andy Priestner called The A to Z of a UK television drama, which is really good, especially the I, Claudius episode, which I know yourself and Mark will be interested in.
Definitely.
Yeah, and he's got me on there talking about Doctor Who and, of course, this very podcast that we are currently speaking on.
Did you plug us outrageously and shamelessly?
Not only did I plug us, I plugged us more fervently than a 1980s hairdresser. It was ludicrous. You're going to see those plugs from space.
So are they quite au fait with Doctor Who himself?
Yes, he is, yes. Yeah, we were talking quite a bit about, you know, the old days with UK Gold and the repeats on BBC Two and, you know, when the VHSs and the DVDs were coming out leading onto the Blu-rays and then, of course, the show as it is now as well. But it's more sort of geared toward the classic era because, of course, this was, you know, yeah, talking about when I was growing up watching the show. And Vision on Sound is more of a...
Ooh. You know, I reckon there's a book in there somewhere.
Yeah, I might have to get on that.
What you say, Vision on Sound what, sorry?
Vision on Sound can be found at Vision on Sound 1 on Twitter and on the Manchester radio station Fab International Radio on Sundays at 7 o'clock. So I'm sure we'll drop a link when it goes out.
So your show's going out on the Sunday at 7 p.m?
Yeah.
Right, okay, and from the look of it, if you go towards fabradiointernational.com /podcasts, it looks like they probably podcast it as well.
Yes, they do, yeah. Yeah, they do.
Let's see. Right. What were you saying about DWM having copied our 50 scariest moments, Hayden?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say copied, I'd more say plagiarised.
Outrageously plagiarised.
Yeah, I mean, you may cast your minds back, dear listeners, to around about this time last year when we released our two-parter Halloween episode. It was the countdown where we sort of went through chronological order of all the scary moments that we found terrifying in Doctor Who over the years. And lo and behold, DWM have done the same.
What a nerve. What a nerve. Do you remember when it was?
October last year.
It was about a year ago because it was just coming up to Halloween.
Kickboxing on the Wreck, hang on.
I think it was that one. I think that was the first part, if I remember correctly. If it's the one with my Captain Scarlet mock-up with Brian May as Colonel White, then it will be That's the first part. Oh, don't you worry, I've got some more of them to come.
Oh, yes, that's Captain Scarlet. Scariest Moments Part 2.
It does genuinely feel like we only did those ones yesterday.
Oh, I remember it now. Yes, it does. Yes, yes. Just looking through the podcast records in our giant ledger that we've got here. Doc rearranges jumpers to prevent heart attacks. Mark pees in a boat. Oh, that's bringing us back. Ghost Town by The Specials.
Oh, terrifying.
And of course, good old Yellow Pages.
Oh, there we are. Thank you. Pass me that boat, will you, Mark?
I think you should let me empty it out first for my last usage of it.
If we don't get this light fixed at the top of this lighthouse, then that boat's definitely going to sink.
I'm going to row back to the light, sure.
I'm not cleaning up.
I suppose we are reaching the Halloween-y witching hour. I'm not particularly an aficionado of trick-or-treat myself at Halloween, but I have been spending the last week or so cobber-coaling around the neighbourhood.
Pardon?
Cobber-coaling.
What is that?
Have neither of you ever heard of cobber-coaling?
No.
Oh, dear.
Did he play for West Brom?
I suppose I ought not to. I think it's gone the way of all flesh these days, but it's a combination of penny for the guy and trick-or-treat, I suppose. So when we used to actually have bonfires on the 5th of November, the kids would go around the local streets knocking on neighbours' doors, and in the same way that when you say trick-or-treat, the friendly neighbour would give you some sweets or something. They'd give you either some pennies, which you could then use to go and buy fireworks at a shop for bonfire nights, or they'd contribute to the bonfire. Hang on, they'd go out back and bring out a battered old wooden crate or a chair leg that you could put on your cart, or these kids, and wheel down to a local rec where you're building your bonfire. And I know it's not restricted to the north, but it was called cobber-coaling. Mm. And so we would... How did it go? As I remember it, there were a few different tunes. We used to go around singing. I can't remember what I used to do. I'm not sure that I'd have been allowed to, but I can certainly remember it happening. The song would go like this. We come a cobber-coaling, cobber-coaling, cobber-coaling. We come a cobber-coaling for bonfire night. I think there are whole verses of it, but I think we only, being of that age, we would probably have sung it in a slightly more high-pitched child's voice. Happy days, happy days. Things were much safer in those days, you know, when children were just allowed out on their own to
sing for strangers.
Go around neighbours' houses asking for money or old bits of splintered wood, which we'd use to build a giant bonfire on a piece of wasteland. And then we'd spend the money by just walking into shops and asking for a box of fireworks with no need for adult supervision at all.
Yeah, it's a golden age.
Did you used to have bonfires when you were kids?
Yeah.
Of course we did. Yeah. The only difference is I had to be supervised by an adult. Meanwhile, Doc's in the middle of the bonfire while it's raging, feeding it more like a furnace with coal.
We used to have treacle toffee. Parking cake. This is nothing northern. That's Yorkshire anyway. Treacle toffee and parking cake, and if you were good, you were allowed to have a sparkler that you'd use to draw shapes in the air with.
And sword fight with your friends with.
Yeah. Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? Do you think that's where George Lucas got the idea of lightsabers from? Playing with sparklers.
Of course, yeah. Could have been.
Don't try this at home.
Those of you who are not in the UK, because I know we have a vast international audience, Bonfire Night is, of course, the 5th of November, when we celebrate, well, some celebrate the failure of Guy Fawkes to blow up Parliament, and some celebrate a damn near miss. I wonder if in places like Canada and Australia and New Zealand, where you've got that direct sort of British link. I wonder if they have any... I doubt if they do it now. They have had Bonfire Night on the 5th of November. Let us know if you know. Of course, our guy that we would have been taking around on a little go-kart this year has been an effigy of Chris Chibnall.
Yeah. I was going to say, it's not an actual guy, isn't it? It's not like some dude.
No.
It's purely a dummy.
Hayden, you've been finding books in your loft again, haven't you?
Oh, have I just. It was my last venture up there as well, because it was the last time that my mum needs that loft, essentially. I've completely cleared it out now. But before an awful lot of things went in a skip, I found some more... God, this is... I don't know whether this is hilarious or tragic, but I found another reading notebook. This is from... I reckon I've been year five here, because this is sort of 98 to 99. And...
So you'd been, what, 10?
I'd have been 9 going on 10. Oh, no, hang on, sorry. No, I would have been year four. This would have been... Yeah, the first half of this is year four, so I would have been 8 going on 9.
Right.
Now, in my book and on this podcast, I may have spoken about getting the Web of Fear out of my local library, yes?
Yes,
I may have mentioned it every now and then. And I mentioned that I got it, and also in my book, Child Out of Time, Growing Up with Doctor Who During the Wilderness Years, available from all good bookshops, and I may have mentioned in there that I rented it out so often that I ended up keeping the book.
No, I've not heard that story before.
Have you not? Oh, yeah, I thought I might have mentioned it. But... Okay, so, basically, I've discovered my library card, which details how often I actually got it out. So,
is it a cardboard one or a plastic one?
No. It was the reading record book. So it records in there the dates when we took things out of the library, okay? So I took Doctor Who and the Web of Fear, and this definitely was not the first time, because I think it was 97, I think, the first time. But anyway, 27th of January, then again on the 29th, then again on the 30th, then on the 2nd of February, then on the 4th of February, the 5th of February, the 6th of February, and then I had a bit of a break and went back to it on the 12th of February. And then I read another book called Agent Zed Goes Wild, with which my mother left this remark. Could Hayden please change this book, as he dislikes some of the descriptions? Page 45. He blew his own head off with a grenade. Not good bedtime reading.
Agent what?
Agent Zed Goes Wild. So, to be honest with you, that sounds like a title of something you would find on an adult website now, let alone in a children's library. But anyway... Each to their own.
Your relationship with the Web of Fear book is very similar to my one with the Teach Yourself Kung Fu that I was obsessed with getting out of the library around the same age.
Now immortalised in your thumbnail sketch of you by the Rev. Those dates you were reading out, Hayden, were you actually taking it out of the library?
Yeah.
That's a period of a few weeks. You had to take it out several times.
Yeah.
Don't they stamp it and say, yes, it's got to be back in a month or so?
No.
You've got 24 hours, brat.
We didn't have a librarian in the school library. It was just the teachers basically keeping a tab on our reading record books. So anyway, I then went cold turkey for a bit. And then when I entered year five, this is on the 14th of October, I've written down book and page number, Doctor Who and the Web of Fear. And my mum's put a cross through it and put, Reddit, 2 exclamation marks. I then changed tack and then read a few other little things like Roald Dahl and whatever. And then by the 22nd of March 1999, I'd gone back to Doctor Who and the Web of Fear. And within here is the last record of the time I took it out of the library. So by the age of 10, or nearly 10 even, sorry, I thought, nah, I'm not going to return it. So I didn't. I moved on to Power of the Daleks, though, between the 17th of May and the 24th of May. And then by the 15th of June, I'd moved on to The Five Doctors. But I did come across another little play, which is very much in the vein of my Captain Scarlet reimagining, where I've recast certain elements of a Doctor Who short story that I've written.
Oh, yes!
Yes, this one's called The Cybermen. So again, it's very original, as you can tell. Now, okay, it starts off quite conventional. So the Doctor I've written here is played by Patrick Troughton. You know, that's kind of what you'd expect from a child of the 90s. And then the companion is played by Fraser Hines. Okay, yep, Doctor and Jamie, loved them when I was a kid. You know, fantastic. This is where it all gets a bit strange and a bit weird. The Cyber Leader is played by John Noakes. And the Cyberman, so not even the Cyber Leader,
get
the
down
Cyberman.
Jep.
The Cyberman is played by none other than Roger Moore.
You will be like us.
which story is this?
This is a little story that I wrote.
Oh, all right, it's not an actual Doctor Who story.
With a non-canonical pointy TARDIS I've drawn here, and a Cyberman who looks like he's got a kettle glued to the side of his face, which I presume is the aforementioned Roger Moore. Now, this is very strange, because the rest of everything I've said wasn't. But anyway, this is the short story, okay? Episode 1. The Doctor and Jamie had just left the TARDIS to look for the Ice Warriors. But they have got a problem. Doctor, I can see a silver robot in the sun, said Jamie. Maybe it is an Ice Warrior on the lookout, said the Doctor. Suddenly, the robot jumped on the Doctor and took him to a hiding cave. When the Doctor woke up, he saw the Cyber Leader. Why do you want me? Said the Doctor. For you to be my slave, said the Cyber Leader.
Naughty Noakesy.
Which has all kinds of imagery racing through my mind of John Noakes physically attacking Patrick Troughton in the Cyberman uniform.
Well, as long as it's not the Cyberwoman uniform.
No, well, exactly. Why would Patrick Troughton be wearing the Cyberwoman uniform?
John Noakes.
Why would John Noakes? That's the image. The picture of the Cyberwoman with John Noakes' face on it. That's going to be the image of the podcast. Anyway, and I've also, before I bore everyone to tears, there's just one little bit that I put here as well about Doctor Who and the Web of Fear. Would you Adam and Eve it? With a picture of Patrick Troughton drawn in pencil, which makes him look a bit like one of the Home Pride people. I've given it 5 stars. I mean, would and I've written, ever since I watched the first episode of Doctor Who, I felt like I like him. And here's a brilliant book, and is the first to Fincher, Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart. And so say all of us.
Interesting little story you wrote there, Hayden. I see that neither your plotting nor your spelling has improved much.
I'm not going to dignify that with a response, let alone.
So just remind us, Hayden, these reading books are a record of... Well, I say remind us, we know, but the listeners might have forgotten. The listeners might long ago have drunk themselves senseless trying to forget it.
The reading record book was something which we used at our school to keep a track of the reading habits of the pupils, of which mine was incredibly obsessed with the Web of Fear. I mean, I look at it now and I wonder whether why my parents never put me through therapy at an early age, really. John Noakes and Roger Moore in Doctor Who. Who'd have thought? Actually, Doctor, I have had a well-prepared meal.
With a martini.
That's the...
What have I been up to else? Reading a book about Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, actually.
Oh!
Sort of making of, during which friend of the show from Podcast 40, Kevin Davis, gets several mentions. And it led me to re-listening to the original series. The original radio series.
Yeah, it's that before they had television and radio. They used to just sort of put it on a railway and you had to go and stand. It'll be on in a minute.
Is that the reason why when you used to buy CDs back in the day, the songs would be called tracks?
Oh,
come on. I thought that was pretty good.
Oh, wait, that's what sparked it off, because at the beginning of October, those CDs arrived. The CDs of the original vinyl albums they did of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and The Restaurant at the End of the Universe. And reading this book reminded me, I'd completely forgotten about this, when you originally bought the paperback book, of the first two books. There was, as I used to be in those days, in the 70s, a tear out or a cut out, a scissors cut out form at the back that you could send off with a postal order to get the double vinyl album sent posted to you, which I must have done at some stage. Much better than the radio, I've always thought, with the Paddy Kingsland's music from the Radiophonic Workshop. This was the original radio broadcast.
The story so far. In the beginning, the universe was created. This has made a lot of people very angry and been widely regarded as a bad move. Many races believe that it was created by some sort of god, though the Jatravatid people of Viltvotal 6 firmly believe that the entire universe was, in fact, sneezed out of the nose of a being called the Great Green Arkelseizure. The Jatravatids, who live in perpetual fear of the time they call the coming of the Great White Handkerchief, are small blue creatures with more than 50 arms each, who are therefore unique in being the only race in history to have invented the aerosol deodorant before the wheel.
And this was the vinyl version.
The story so far. In the beginning, the universe was created. This has made a lot of people very angry and been widely regarded as a bad move. Many races believe that it was created by some sort of god, though the Jatravatid people of Viltvotal 6 firmly believe that the entire universe was, in fact, sneezed out of the nose of a being called the Great Green Arkelseizure. The Jatravatids, who live in perpetual fear of the time they call the coming of the Great White Handkerchief, are small blue creatures with more than 50 arms each, who are therefore unique in being the only race in history to have invented the aerosol deodorant before the wheel.
But I also, being in a hitchhiker's mood this month, I also watched the original TV series streaming on Netflix, and, or was it Amazon? One of the two. I'd remembered how much I disliked it, because they'd recast Ford Prefect. Is it David Dixon?
Yeah.
Instead of Jeffrey McGiven. I didn't think it was that good. And I thought didn't delivered his lines slightly too fast, so you couldn't hear them. How dare he be different? Anyway.
I have to say, I think it influences you in whichever medium you first experienced Hitchhikers. And I have to say, for me, I watched the TV series first, and I absolutely love David Dixon as Ford Prefect.
Yeah, I'm the same as well.
Oh, I'm sure I would have if I'd watched that one first.
Yeah.
Excuse me. I listened to the original broadcasts when they were first transmitted.
I mean, he's no Mos Def, but anyway, you know.
Mos Def. Couldn't understand why they cast him for that film. I like the film even less, actually. The best thing about the TV thing for me was, you know, the graphics when they were doing the readings from the book?
Yes.
I thought that was quite extraordinarily good. Mm. I had no idea that they were, I suppose, given that the period it was, that they wasn't computerised. It was actually people drawing...
Hand animated, yeah.
Individual frames, like an animation.
Well, we've had one of the men who did that on the show, haven't we? Kevin Davis.
Oh, yes, of course, that's the other thing.
Hi, Kevin.
In the United States, there's a, somewhere on YouTube, there's a current affairs program where they're talking about the rightness or wrongness of invading Afghanistan after 9/11. And the pundits they've got on the panel are Salman Rushdie, Christopher Hitchens, and Mos Def.
Right.
And okay. Mos Def is talking out of his backside about something to do with cocaine crops, heroin crops in Afghanistan. And Christopher Hitchens has clearly decided that it's outrageously beneath him to have to appear on any discussion program with Mos Def. Spends the whole program addressing him as Mr. Definitely. To take the piss. That is quite funny, actually.
All right.
Wait, let me watch a Bin Laden video.
Let me finish.
You haven't watched a Bin Laden video. You've never watched. You're telling me
It's been right. quite a while since
I don't speak Arabic. I don't speak Arabic, and I don't trust the media. So I don't just trust everything that comes over the airwaves. As I say
exactly
again,
exactly where you're coming from now. And you haven't watched one. You haven't watched.
No, he's saying he doesn't believe the translation.
I don't believe the translation. I don't speak Arabic. So all I ask is simple questions.
Watch it like me with an Arab-speaking friend. Look at a decent translation. You're telling me all this is new to you. You don't know or believe any of it.
Mr. Hitchens, what I said as I asked the question is what was Al-Qaeda's political objective? What was their aim? And has it ever been clearly defined? That's it.
You've already told me that you wouldn't take it just from me.
Yes.
Okay. No, I wouldn't. I wouldn't just take it from just anybody. You wouldn't just take this information from me.
Do a bit of work on your own account. Sure,
I do. I do work on my own account. I don't start no shit, Mr. Hitchens. I'm from Brooklyn.
Mr. Definitely.
I'm not afraid of nothing.
Mr. Definitely, I'm from Hampshire.
So, anyway, did we say that your parents used to comment in the...
Yeah, they did. Yeah.
In the book. Author Terence Dicks. Doctor in the Web of Fear. Author Terence Dicks. Ever since I watched the first episode of Doctor Who, I have felt like him.
Felt like him.
This is a brilliant book and is the first to feature Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart.
Yeah.
Feature. F-I-C-H-E-R. So when did you write this head?
About 20 minutes ago, and you needed a comment to read out.
I keep coming across this sort of stuff.
What, children's reading writing books? What?
No, but when my mum's clearing stuff out, right. She'll come across some little amazing comic that I thought I was writing when I was little.
Mm.
Oh, Charlie the Great Glass Elevator.
Yes, which I enjoyed more than The Chocolate Factory, actually.
It's more active, isn't it? Oh, it's all Doctor Who.
Yeah. It would have been that summer. It would have been the summer of 99 when I met Deborah Watling as well and made my confession that I'd stolen that book.
I like your explanation of explosions in one of your reading books. Explosions mean, if you hear a big bang, an explosion has gone off. Oh.
This isn't Doctor Who related. This is my description of Bonfire Night, which includes an explosion. And this is even younger. I'm about 5'4", 3'2", 1". No, I think I'm about 5 or 6 when I did this one. Because I've got really chunky lettering and it's not joined up yet.
Right. This week, Faithless Sisters, we're looking at the Season 15 Fourth Doctor story, The Horror of Fang Rock. It was Graham Williams' first story, wasn't it?
Mm.
And we're going to have it introduced by a recording that we've managed to get hold of Terence Dicks reading the prologue from his novelisation of the story. Let's just see if I can find the tape. Oh, here we are. I'll just slip it in. And press play.
The Legend of Fang Rock. Fang Rock Lighthouse, centre of a series of mysterious and terrifying events at the turn of the century, is built on a rocky island a few miles off the Channel coast. So small is the island that wherever you stand, its rocks are wet with sea spray. Everywhere you hear the endless thundering of the waves as they crash on the jagged coastline that has given Fang Rock its name. The lighthouse tower is in the centre of the island. A steep flight of steps leads up to the heavy door in its base, you see. This gives entry to the lower floor, where the big steam-driven generator throbs steadily away, providing power for the electric lantern. Coal bunkers occupy the west of this lower area, you see. Winding stairs lead up to the crew room, where the men eat, sleep, and spend most of their leisure time. Next to the crew room is a tiny kitchen. Above more storerooms and the head keeper's private cabin, and above them the service rooms, where tools and spare parts are kept, you see. Together with rockets, maroons, flares, and a variety of other warning devices. Finally, a short, steep iron stairway leads up into the lamp room, a glassed-in circular chamber at the very top of the tower. Dominated by the giant carbon arch lamp with its gleaming glass prisms, you see. Feng Wok has had an evil reputation from its earliest days. Soon after it was built, two men died in mysterious circumstances, and a third went mad with fear. There have been strange rumours, stories of a great glowing beast that comes out of the sea. But all is forgotten now. It is the early 1900s, you see, and the age of science is in full swing. Newly converted from oil to electricity, Feng Wok Lighthouse stands tall and strong. The great shining lantern warning ships away from the jagged reefs around the little island. As night falls one fine autumn evening, the lamp is burning steadily. The three men who make up the crew go peacefully about their duties, unaware of the night of horror that lies before them, little knowing that they would soon be caught up in a strange and terrible conflict with the fate of the Earth itself as the final stake.
Right, as I said, Horror of Feng Wok is written by Terence Dix. Quite notoriously, when Robert Holmes, a script editor, gave him the task, he said, "I don't know anything about lighthouses." And he was told to go down to the library and get a book on it.
I find it really cheap. I'm sorry. It's really, really cheap when people try and do interpretations of Terence Dix's voice.
I'm sorry.
Absolutely offensive. You never catch me doing it.
Now, I'll try not to be offensive again, Hayden. But when Uncle Terence got to the library, he found that some thieving git had stolen the relevant book on lighthouses. And so he had to borrow Lighthouses of Wales, Their Architecture and Archaeology by Douglas B. Haig. Oh, that was the situation, wasn't it? Terence had originally written a song that's going to be called The Vampire Mutations.
A story.
Should I say a song?
Yeah. It's The Vampire Mutations.
And then was told at the last minute that the BBC was in the middle of preparing a big, spectacular dramatisation of Dracula, and people might think they were taking the mickey out of them. So he was told to replace it. Made at Pebble Mill, which is the BBC's Birmingham studios, because there was something wrong with the studios at Television Centre in London.
Yes, that very much connects it to my childhood, because I do remember growing up with Pebble Mill on during the... Is it Pebble Mill at One?
Yeah.
Pebble Mill, I was about to say Pebble Mill at One every lunchtime.
Yeah.
What's the most dull?
Yeah.
Sort of, what do you call it? Magazine show, wasn't it?
A bit like the One Show.
Yeah.
But even less interesting.
It's amazing on that, on all the DVD extras, how many interviews there are with doctors and companions on Pebble Mill at One. That I can't bring myself to watch because it's so boring.
Yeah. I seem to remember even dreading the theme tune coming on. It always used to like, oh. I mean, to be fair, I should have been at school anyway, not hiding in a cupboard.
It must have been school holidays, surely. In which case, you should have been out playing in the streets, in the fields. And so the Vampire Mutations eventually got morphed later into State of Decay several seasons later.
Mm-hmm.
What did we think? Who'd like to make a start?
Can I not?
Are you still trying to recover your voice?
Yeah.
Well, I'll start with a bit, but it's not necessarily going to be everything I'd say. This story seems to have had such a troubled birth that I'm amazed it's come out as anything but rubbish, because like they had to change studios to move up to Pebble Mill, which annoyed everyone for starters, because although, was it the facilities weren't so good, or was it that the technicians weren't so good? I can't remember which one it was now.
I think it was the facilities. Didn't the technicians have to break into a next door studio
in order
to get another camera? I think from what we hear, the technicians all went out of their way.
Yeah, that's right. So the facilities weren't as good. Yeah, so the facilities weren't as good, but the technicians were fine. But then you had and Tom, that pissed Tom off because he was having to go up to Birmingham to film. He was already very... He was taking ownership of the show at this point, wasn't he?
Yes.
Really? This was just really the start of it. And he hadn't been particularly welcoming to Louise Jameson. He wasn't keen on the character of Leela, and I think he took that out on Louise Jameson.
Mm.
He didn't get on well initially with Paddy Russell because she was trying to get him to stick to the script and do exactly what she said, and he was obviously trying to dictate the terms of the show.
Mm.
And so there's all that friction. And also the fact that it was a last-minute reasonably last-minute script, and you know it got changed around because of the whole Dracula thing, and I just think with that, it just sounds like it should be an absolute disaster. They had to film it in these lighthouse sets that it's very difficult to move the cameras around in, and they're quite small sets, and you know you've got those curved stairs, haven't you, with the curved, I mean they're beautiful sets, they really are.
Wonderful, yeah.
Yeah, I love the curved doors as well inside them, just to...
Yes, it is nice, that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's lovely. And it works because it does give the story the feeling of claustrophobia it needs. But it must have been absolute hell to try and get the cameras around it and to try to get the framing right. And yet somehow, despite all this, I come out with an absolute classic of an episode. I think, apart from some dodgy special effects, which have been done on the cheap, they basically work narratively, don't they? You know, they give you the impression of what you need to know, even if they're not all that convincing. Apart from some of the dodgy special effects, I think this is a superb episode. Absolutely brilliant. It's one of the best episodes of Doctor Who ever made, I think. Because despite all the problems, it's directed beautifully. It looks absolutely perfect. A lot of the camera angles that Paddy Russell's managed to get in, they look really nice. We were watching Sweeney the other night, weren't we,
Doc? Yeah.
And we watched a Douglas Camfield directed episode. And some of the framing of, like, when there's two or more people in shot and way people move in and out of the frame and the lines of the background and stuff, you know, they did look like mini works of art sometimes, some of the frames, didn't they? And I think it's the same with this. I think some of the framing of it looks great. I think the darkness of it in places as well works really well for it. I know Tom Baker was afraid that his auntie Wynne wouldn't be able to see him on screen or something, apparently. But yeah, it looks fantastic. And I think the acting from pretty much everyone in it is pretty sound. But I think Tom and Louise in particular are absolutely superb. I know that this was like a... oh, what do you call it? Not a breaking point. This is like a...
turning point?
Turning point, yeah.
Yeah, this was like a turning point for their relationship, wasn't it? Because Louise Jameson was getting fed up of Leela being written like Sarah Jane, you know, not like the aggressive woman that she started off as being. And you can see how much of that she must put back into the script. And I think because she became quite forceful with that, and she's pushing against that with the... Paddy Russell and the script she'd been given, and she was pushing against Tom. Tom actually started respecting her because of that, but her performance in this is just brilliant. Things like when the boat crashes at the end of episode one, and it's a bit just after the boat crashes, and Leela says, "They will all die then." It's like she kind of...
She's missing the empathy of a human companion, isn't she?
Exactly,
at that point,
yes.
A human companion would go, "Doctor, we've got to go help them."
But for her, it's like, "They're all going to die."
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And this one's just like...
Yeah, and Leela's grown up with death. It's very much... I mean, that's the thing. The Doctor and Leela's lack of empathy throughout this is fantastic. It makes them seem like they're from different worlds. You know, when Adelaide starts breaking down in the slapser. And when Adelaide faints with horror on the floor and Leela just rolls her eyes... And then even at the end, when everyone else has died and Tom and Leela wander back to the TARDIS and there's sort of like a little bit of laughing and stuff, and like, haven't we had a nice adventure?
When Vince is dead. I don't mind. When Vince is dead, I don't mind any of the others, but Vince is dead. How can they be not be distraught?
It's also, isn't it kind of weird how Skinsale dies? Like the way the Doctor throws the diamonds down and looks at Skinsale.
It's almost as if he's daring him to go after them, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because he doesn't just pick one diamond and then just casually chuck the others away. He picks one and then deliberately throws the others downstairs, isn't it?
Yeah, scatters them, doesn't he?
So I think that, I mean, you will note that Tom is by far my favourite Doctor, but the older I get, the less willing I am to excuse his nonsense. I mean, this whole thing that keeps coming through this door, not on cue, and so he's ruining a scene for Louise. And eventually she just keeps saying, "No, can we stop the filming there? Sorry, you did that wrong, can you do that again?" She does about three times before he does it right. And then this idea that, oh, that from then on he respects her because she stood up for him. I can't think why anyone thinks there's anything admirable about behaving like a prick and then if someone stands up to you about it, think, oh, I respect you now. You just, you don't do that. And you see more and more of this. We hear about these BBC technicians at Pebble Mill who, it can't be easy, can it, in Birmingham, where you're constantly, you know, you've got this debate over which is the second city of England. Is it Birmingham or is it London? And they're clearly thinking, oh, here we've got this great Doctor Who, a show everyone's actually heard of, is coming to us. And they go out of their way to do everything they can to try and make it good for them. And Tom is, and I think you get the impression from the stories you hear, that they're slightly pissed off that Tom doesn't like having to drive up to Birmingham, makes it very clear he doesn't. And he treats Louise like that. And with Paddy Russell, I mean, there aren't that many, you probably count on the fingers of one finger the number of female directors in Doctor Who. And when she starts putting her foot down and insisting that he behaves himself, he starts calling her sir throughout it, which you might think, the first time you hear that, thinking, oh, ho, ho, funny old Tom. But you think, don't you? That's quite a nasty thing to do, that. Sir, because you're effectively taking the piss out of the director in front of everyone else. You're someone who the director can't sack because he's the permanent character of the Doctor. And I've also been thinking, just looking at this, because I thought there were some good scenes of him in this, but he's nowhere near. What was the previous story?
Oh, it was Talons is the previous
Talons, story. Yeah. He's nowhere near like he is in Talons or in Robots of Death. And I was just glancing through the rest of his stories that's coming up. And there aren't, from this point on, there aren't that many where I think, oh, what an amazing Tom performance. I mean, there's quite a few. But up to now, it's almost been solidly, yes, I can see why I think he's my favourite Doctor. From now on, so, I mean, certainly from post-Key to Time, it's certainly the case. But from now on, it starts being the case where post-Key to Time is where I start making excuses for him. And apart from the odd thing like City of Death or Full Circle, there's very little of it that I particularly want to watch again. But it's from here, I think, you can see he starts going down that road towards that. Possibly because he loses Philip Hinchcliffe, who was the director who hired him. Well, it was sort of, but he was his first director, wasn't he?
Yeah.
First producer. So he must have had some sort of hold over Tom over in that sort of sense. It just all seems very silly for me. It makes me sad because I'm thinking, when I've read some of these stories about the technicians thinking, oh, amazing, we get to show the BBC that we can pull their chestnuts out of the fire and do Doctor Who for them, and we'll be getting Tom Baker, you know, working with us. And they find him behaving like a prick and how disappointed they are. And it reminds me a bit of Matthew Waterhouse's book, Blue Box Boy.
Oh, yeah.
Where as a young fan, he's cast in the show. He turns up at the Acton Hilton, the rehearsal rooms, you know, expecting, oh, I've got to be working with my hero, Tom Baker. And Tom and Lala are doing the, you know, I'm not looking at you, sulky thing. You know, that sort of era of their relationship.
Yeah.
And everyone else is almost ignored. And you think, that's unforgivable, that, isn't it? You know, you hear about, I'm going off the subject a bit here, but it's something that upsets me. It's like, you know, you hear about John Pertwee almost was notorious for going the other way, wasn't he? In the rehearsals, Katie would go out of their way to make newcomers to the show, you know, one-off characters, the new actors feel welcome.
Or Troughton and Hines and Deborah Watling.
Yes, exactly.
And Wendy Padbury as well would do that too. Yeah.
I mean, I can't imagine I'd have been overjoyed doing that Harry Roy thing every morning with John. But at least you'd have felt welcome. But to turn us around, to feel, I mean, there's this story that John Abbott, who plays Vince, who's, I think this is his first ever TV show, and he stumbles on his lines at one point, and Tom upbraids him for forgetting his lines, snatches his script off him and throws it out of the window.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because really what we're doing is we're berating the kind of madness and the silliness that Tom, that has been embraced on the other side, you know, on that sort of spectrum of his character.
I thought you were going to say we're berating the sort of madness and silliness exactly the way we behave towards guests on our own podcast.
No, but it's true. I mean, he, you know, that kind of thing that you kind of expect from Tom Baker. You know, he's playing up to it, really, and he's not got anyone to rein him in. Mm. I mean, yeah, I think we said earlier, you know, we said earlier about this being a tipping point. Well, it is for a number of reasons, because, you know, like we said, this is the first...
Tipping point, that was the word we were looking for.
Yeah, this is the first Graham Williams story, and this is already beset with problems. You've got a lead who isn't respecting the leading lady or the director. It's a very tense atmosphere. Like you said, the sets are all quite small. They've had to uproot. And it seems to start off a 3-year period where there are troubles with the cast or with the people behind the scenes. A really disruptive period. And it actually, some of the blame of that does have to be at Tom's door. You know, being the leading man, like you said, you know, you would expect... Well, I don't know. I mean, but I would, you know, if I was in Doctor Who now, I expect, you know, Jodie Whittaker's the face of the show. You know, there's some responsibility that comes with that. But Tom just seems to behave like a petulant child.
Mm.
But one of the things is that it doesn't come across like it does in State of Decay. It doesn't quite come across that way yet on screen.
No.
On screen, no. He does still seem to be the Doctor of the early, of the Hinchcliffe era, essentially. But something I noticed... And I'm not certain of how many other stories can boast this, but it seems to have the most involvement of people who produce Doctor Who over the years, because Philip Hinchcliffe commissioned it, Graham Williams obviously produced it, and John Nathan Turner was the floor manager.
And Peter Grimwade works on it, sir.
And Peter Grimwade was working on it. Terence Dicks obviously wrote it. Robert Holmes script edited it. Paddy Russell, who did Pyramids of Mars, directed Pyramids of Mars, is back again. And Dudley Simpson, like all of these mixtures putting together makes for one hell of a story. But it surprises me that not one of them, or any of the actors, ever told Tom just to shut up.
Yeah.
Or to just behave. Because I don't think anyone would. I certainly will. You know, I know it's different personalities and what have you. And I suppose some people may think, oh dear, if I do stand up to him, then maybe I'll never work for the BBC again. I mean, there was clearly a fear culture in the 70s.
I mean, it's really, that's the role of the director or the producer, isn't it? Do that. It's not for the other actors to do it.
Yeah, but if you put your head up above the pulpit in the 70s, you were on the scrap heap. If you crossed the likes of Ronnie Barker... Or even, I hate to, you know, JS, let's refer to him. If, you know, you were out, you would never work for the BBC ever again. So I think there's a bit of a fear culture there that may be one of the reasons.
Yes, that's interesting. And actually, if you believe the rumours, there was another producer showrunner that present, because while they were filming this...
Spider-Man does...
Bloody hell. Christ. Dear, oh dear. But it's interesting because I came to this quite late, Horror Fang Rock. This is one of those that I bought in a big bundle from WH Smith when the DVDs were on sale about 10 years ago. And because of the lack of making of, which we've kind of become accustomed to with the Blu-rays and DVDs nowadays, I didn't know of any of this. I knew it was filmed up in Birmingham at Pebble Mill. But I just thought that was down to, you know, availability at Television Centre. I didn't think it was because, you know, a whole host of reasons.
Was it anything other than the fact that there was technical issues or a strike or something?
I thought that the studio was fully booked.
Oh, possibly.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
So what are these other host of other reasons, you mean? A host of other reasons why it's filmed in Birmingham, or a host of other reasons why it has a reputation as having been difficult?
Oh, no, the second, the latter.
Right, I see, yeah, that makes sense, yeah. But I mean, I haven't said that, you know, I worship the ground that Tom works on, but works on.
Well, he was a builder, so maybe he did do some road laying.
That's
at some
true.
Point, so,
yeah.
Maybe you shouldn't investigate your heroes too closely.
Well, actually, I mean, we berate Patrick Troughton for having two families. Tom Baker ran out on his young children.
Yeah, I know.
So I mean, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, and that never gets dragged up, does it? So.
I think Tom's done a lot of work since this time to...
Mending broken fences, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. Which I think helps a lot. Because Louise Jameson does absolutely adore him now.
That is true.
That's very clear and quite genuine, I believe.
I mean, we've all been dicks. So let me rephrase that. I mean, you've all been dicks at some times during your life, haven't you?
Oh, God, yeah. I was dicks about half an hour ago.
If you move from a building site direct into being a children's hero on primetime TV, but of course it's got to go, you know, to your head, isn't it?
I think it's more disturbing that there weren't people around to maybe rein him in or have a word.
Well, can I also say, just in Tom's defence, he did care incredibly about the part.
Oh, yeah,
He did care incredibly about how it came across on television. He cared about how he came across in public. But yeah, he was still a dick, but some of that did come from just the fact he was too wrapped up in it and he did care too much. And like you say, there was nobody there to say no, because it was, he had, the show was incredibly popular. Yeah, it was.
Yeah. Patty Russell seemed to be able to rein him in when she was directing Pyramids, didn't she? Because he was still fairly new to the role.
Yes.
Whereas now Sarah's gone, so he's the, you know, really the big star now. And perhaps she didn't get the support she's got. If she wants to take him to task, then she's got to be supported by Graham Williams, who, this is his first story.
Also, it's not a story that Graham Williams chose, was it? This is one that was had already been...
I think you make a very good point about how in recent years, and as time's gone by, Tom Baker's actually made amends and made... I think that is what sort of separates... You're right, I mean, we've all been a bit of a dick in the past, and it's as long as you sort of learn from that and apologise for it or change your ways, then actually it's a lesson learned, really. And I think that's definitely something, because, yeah, you are right. I mean, he's very close to Louise Jameson. John Leeson as well, isn't he? Very close to John Leeson.
Oh, well, they always got on well, though, didn't they?
Now, you see, for me, if there was a bloke running around on all fours in the recording studio, that would annoy me more than some guy fluffing his lines and then chucking your script out.
Well, Tom preferred it to the actual canine, didn't he?
Yeah. So,
Doc, you said you didn't think much of a great deal of Tom's performance in this.
Oh, no, I thought it was perfectly adequately Tom. And there are some scenes which I think he's really good at, but I think a lot of it he's coasting. You know, he does that bit, I've got something to tell you all.
And he does a little laugh and then says, anyone interested, and does that huge grin. That is superb. You don't like that? I think that is absolutely...
I think that's really good, actually.
Peak Tom Doctor. It's just... it's fantastic.
It's so that, weird and alien.
I think you sort of contrast that with when he's sitting there and he's quite near the front of the shot, so to speak, but he's just kind of looking off into the middle distance, really brooding, which possibly is from the fact that he's... in such a bad mood, but he's just sat there silently in the front of the frame, really brooding, while there's people talking behind him in the shot about what's going on, and then suddenly he'll just interject over someone's sentence and like snaps out of his brooding as if he looks like he's concentrating completely on something else, but then immediately joins in the conversation. It's just, I think it works really well for me. I absolutely love it. I mean, one thing I don't like particularly is the way he says chameleon.
Yes, exactly.
But that's clearly him just...
But having said that, I think that close of episode 3 is that he's brilliant in that way. He does his leader out make a terrible mistake.
Yeah.
That's extraordinarily good. And the same, maybe at the other end of the thing, where he's being more light-hearted, where he's sitting on the steps taking the piss out of the Rutan. I think that's very good. And there are lovely bits in it. It's just that there's stuff like coming straight after. I mean, I believe that Robots of Death is his finest performance. I think he's absolutely extraordinary in that. And then after that comes Talons, which he's, again, is a great one of his. And it just seems to me as it's a bit... I don't know, really. Having said that, I think it's a wonderful story. You have got this sense of claustrophobia, haven't you? which shows you that it actually, the show doesn't need to be epic space opera or on another planet or even outside the tiny confines of a lighthouse. And you never do doubt that it's a lighthouse, do you? You know, no. Down in the ground floor where you've got the generators and you've got that bit where it's clearly it's built into the solid rock. You know, bits in the background of which are solid rock. Mm. And for all that they seem to regret it on the commentary, I love the lamp room. Because they were complaining that, oh, you've designed us this lamp room because it's going to be all glass and so it's transparent. That means that in a studio, we'll have to, you know, surround it with a green screen or something, got CSO. But I think it looks amazing.
Mm.
Now, unless they made that down in London and shipped it up to Birmingham, which I would have thought is seems unlikely.
Looks great, doesn't it?
It looks amazing.
Yeah.
Mm. And same with the little silly things like the curved doors. But of course, none of that would work if it wasn't for some of the casting, the characterisation that they'd done. I love, in the opening scenes, the relationship between the three lighthouse keepers, Vince, Ben, isn't it, and Ruben,
yes.
Where there's a very nice relationship between the three of them. I mean, John Abbott probably just gets away at, I think, 34, at being an 18-year-old by his acting as a sort of naive acting. But it's very much a sort of father-son relationship between him and the other two, isn't there? Where there are, you know, he blows down the speaking tube to speak to one of them downstairs, say the fog's coming up.
Yeah.
And he says, who's down there? He says, oh, it's King Edward, is it? Well, Your Majesty, would you tell the senior keeper that the fog's coming up? Because that's clearly Reuben, who's quite an intimidating sod for the rest of the story, and he's clearly just larking about.
Yeah.
And then they have that little argument about oil and electricity between Ben and Reuben, I think it's really well. So you've got this, you quickly establish this good and close relationship between the three keepers.
Oh, and that's Colin Douglas as Reuben as well, isn't it? And he's brilliant.
Mm.
He's Bruce, isn't he, from Enemy of the World.
Now,
hey, Bruce!
He is.
And also, I believe he's one of Regan's superiors in The Sweeney, isn't he?
Yes, he is, isn't he?
I also believe that he is Colin Baker, time-travelling back 40 years to appear as an older gentleman in Doctor Who. He looks like Colin Baker, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does a bit.
Ralph Watson, who plays Ben, is Captain Knight in Web of Fear, Hayden.
And Terry Jones in Monty Python.
And he's Ettis in Monster of Peladon. Reuben, obviously, is Bruce.
Oh, you're my Bruce now.
I'm not sure the other trio works as well. Lord Palmerdale's obviously a complete prick, isn't he?
Yeah.
I quite like Alan Rose's Skimmer Sail.
Yes.
Possibly because of the contrast between him and Palmerdale. You're quite sympathetic for him, aren't you? He's clearly a rogue, but you quite like it. And, he dies because of his own greed. But you don't think, ha-ha, the fool. You think quite sad, don't you?
Yeah.
And he's quite sympathetic for...
He's got some great hairstyling going on as well.
Yeah. He was Dr. Evans in Moonbase. He was Sir Edward in The Time Warrior. And he was Gareth in Full Circle, who's a sort of the decider who's even less decisive than the
other
three.
Oh, God, he is as well. Yes, he is. Oh, I didn't... Jesus. Yeah. He's Evans in the Moonbase with that amazing quiff.
Dr.
Oh,
Evans.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
But Adelaide, oh, my God. From the very start where she's coming in and he's sitting her down in front of the stove and she says, so, thank you, what's your name? He's on Vince Hawkins. She says, oh, thank you, Hawkins. And you think, oh, you smug bitch. Because she clearly comes across as someone who's trying to be more, up the social scale than she really is. And the constant... Does Leader only slap her once?
It's only once, but it should have been more.
Yeah.
Oh.
Who does she threaten to cut the heart out of? Is that Palmerdale?
I believe so, yes.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, I don't condone violence, but... On this occasion, I'm taking exception to that.
Do you know what? There's something quite shocking about it, though. But it seems very in character for Leela to do.
Mm.
Because she's, like I was saying earlier, she's from somewhere else. So she's got no empathy.
Mm.
It's not sort of behaviour that would be acceptable in society these days. But Yeah, it seems very in character for Leela to do it, but it does. It still comes as quite a shock when you're watching it. Yeah, I'd kind of forgotten it happens, and I was like, oh. But I think it's the eye roll as well, though. When she's saying Leela's eye roll is just brilliant. Oh.
I love the bit where Leela suddenly starts stripping in front of Vince, and he walks past her.
I'm no lady.
Shading his eyes so he can't see her. That was a seminal moment in every sense of the word, in the Rev's life.
Previously on Diddly-Dum.
It's Leela in a baggy jumper. Absolutely sensational.
I was thinking of the Rev when I saw her in that jumper as well. Fond of memories of that episode.
It's funny because I was thinking of the Rev in that jumper.
Those boots, those trousers and that jumper she wears, what on earth are things that fit her that well doing in a lighthouse? Unless Vince used to be very, very slim or something.
That's true, isn't it? That's an astute point. I've got to say, and I know this is skipping to the end here, but I really do like that last scene when the lighthouse explodes and Leela witnesses the explosion and it changes her eye colour. And of course, the reasoning behind that, behind the scenes, was because Louise Jameson was finding the contact lenses uncomfortable that changed her eye colour. So they used the explosion to change it back to her normal blue eyes. And there's quite a nice little bit with them. She's genuinely thinking, well, I'm finished then, because in my culture, if you're old or infirm, you're no use to anyone. Mm. So she asked the doctor to kill her. And the doctor takes the dagger and then just sort of laughs at her, but not in a mocking kind of way. It's just a kind of, it's just that actually you're neither, it's all fine. And I think that may be the turning point potentially on screen between, the fourth doctor melting towards Leela. And I wonder whether it was around that time that Tom started melting towards Leela too, towards Louise too. Perhaps it's...
I don't see the point of those contact lenses, because one, I never noticed what colour her eyes were, or they changed. So they hadn't said anything, I don't think I would have noticed.
It's not as if TVs were in HD, so widescreen, high definition.
Well, most of them were still in black and white in 1977.
Yeah.
Even the Doctor rails against Adelaide, doesn't he? That point where he says, get her out of here. they've got a very strange larder, haven't they, in the lighthouse? Big jars of plums, cherries and prunes.
Oh. Yeah, we didn't see the toilet, did we?
No, I was going to say, it must run and run. I do think the Doctor looks a bit silly hanging out of the window.
That's weird special effects, isn't it? He looks great in that. It's not a bowler. Is it a derby? Is that the hat he was wearing?
Yes, possibly. That's hanging out the window scene. It has to be bad to make Sylvester hanging from his umbrella in Dragon and Fire look quite good by comparison, isn't it? What do we think of the route, then?
So, the first time I ever saw it was on a trailer on one of the... I think it might have been on the Ice Warriors VHS, I think. And it was in a trailer because I think Horror Fang Rock was one of the last... Oh, not one of the last videos. It was a very late video to come out, though. So
yeah, it was
about...
because it had a Black Sheep cover. Do you know what I mean? Company who did those last few... Yeah, yes, and the Ice Warriors was just before that, because that's also a Black Sheep cover. And came with a box. It came in a box, didn't it? Like an actual... Because I've got an Ice Warriors that's...
Yes.
Is it a tip tape thing with...
It had the Missing Years documentary and the Underwater Menace, and it had a booklet, and it had a CD, which is the only part I've still kept, actually. I had a CD with episodes 2 and 3 on there without any without any narration, so I didn't have a bloody clue what was going on. Anyway, it was on there, so it was a very late VHS to come out. And I remember seeing this ball of snot on a staircase and thinking, I mean, even to a 9-year-old's eyes who, at this point, actually, 1998 was probably spending his time reading The Web of Fear, looked at that and just thought, that doesn't look good at all. But it's one of those things that you'd expect Doctor Who to do now, but less to do back then, where they tie something into something completely irrelevant within the story. Mm. You know, it's like...
It's a bit like the Macra turning up in Gridlock.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Or like in Star Trek, where all of a sudden they just bung in a time travel episode for the sheer hell of it. You know, it's kind of like, okay, yeah, this is just showing this is still part of the universe, but what's it doing here? I mean, the Rutan didn't have to be... Well, it didn't have to be a Rutan. It could have been anything, but it's the fact he wanted it to be... We get to see this enemy of the Sontarans. As a kid, I knew who the Rutans were, but I just couldn't quite envisage... little potato people shooting at balls of snot. I just thought, what a crappy war.
wasn't that an old stage play? Oh, what a crappy war.
Exactly.
I have to say, for me, I remember I would have been six when I first saw it, and encountering the glowing, snotty Rutan on a staircase caused me to fill many a boat. And honestly,
was it a steam yacht?
Yeah, it was a steaming yacht. It really, as a six-year-old, it terrified me. I think it's a good choice of creature because of the fact that it's a shape changer. So I think that's good.
Yeah.
I mean, that sort of aspect of it as well really reminds me of The Thing, the 1982 film.
Yes.
The John Carpenter film. There's a lot from that that seems... The Thing does seem like a kind of big budget horror of fang rock, in that there's that shape changer gets into the base. I mean, here it only changes in one person, but it's the it's again, it's that claustrophobia, it's that paranoia and weirdness. I always remember being terrified of Reuben just standing in his room staring. Those bits when he walks up to somebody when he's the Rutan and he's about to kill them, he just does that really creepy smile. It's horrible. It reminds me a bit of The Thing as well, isn't it? Because one of the scientists on the base, you don't know if he's been possessed or not, and he's like wanting to come in, and they're like looking at him, and it's all very it's creepy. Oh, and also heat might be a method of defense, says the Doctor, which is exactly what they use in The Thing.
Yeah, the flamethrower.
Although The Thing's obviously a sequel, it's like a remake of the Thing from Another World.
Oh, the lamp's gone out. God.
Oh no, has it?
How are we going to warn away the ships from the rocks?
Should ask Brucey to get on the exercise bike.
Is there not a big heavy bell that we can hang out on the gallery and strike? That's Famous Five, isn't it? Give the foghorn a pull, will you, Mark?
Okay, I'll give it.
I've got to go downstairs to the generator room to fill it with some more coal. I'm not going down in the dark alone. Follow me down. And so, really, I think it's a very... Do you think it's a quite Terrence-y story?
It feels very Robert Holmes-y in places, which is not surprising because he script edited it.
Well, there are several points at the DVD commentary in which Terrence says, oh, that would have been a line that Bob Holmes put in. I think he probably said about that about the malicious damage line.
Right.
I like the line, we talk about Russell T. Davies being so good at writing characters that in a few lines he can sketch complete character.
Yeah.
Well, I thought it was a bit of a cheat where Palmerdale says, not one of your army stories, Jimmy. They're even more boring than your House of Commons anecdotes. Which essentially tells you this man's whole career in half a sentence, isn't it? Mm. Which is a bit of a cheat. Right, just open up the door of the boiler, would you please, Hayden?
Can you pass me the oven gloves, please, Doc?
Doc, don't forget to keep the boy pressure up.
You be careful with that oven door. The Malicious Damage Act 1861 covers lighthouses, you know. What's that max headroom thing that you're messing around with, Hayden?
Well, I'm pleased that you've asked me, Doc, because... This actually made national headlines back in the day in the US because while a PBS station was showing, I can't remember which episode it was of Horror of Fang Rock, but it was during a scene with Leela and what's his name? The really young guy again.
Vince.
Vince. There's during a scene between Leela and Vince, I think it might be part two, all of a sudden the screen just cut to a man wearing an overgrown Max Headroom mask, burbling inaudible stuff and then getting spanked with a ruler for about a minute and a half before going back to Horror of Fang Rock again. And it was a real... the people who made this, they were never found. They were never identified. It was never traced. It was just this really bizarre interception of a signal, I think. Yeah, never repeated again either. Just a really, really weird thing. And it made the news. It was made like... I've inserted the clips into the computer. So links in the show notes, and if you want to hear them here, folks. But the actual broadcast itself is actually a little creepy, I have to say, because it is a bit disorientating, and it's just a bit... It's really weird and really strange. But yeah, So it must be the only Doctor Who story that's made it onto national news in the United States. Yeah, that's a consequence.
Even in a medium that is no stranger to bizarre moments, these were truly bizarre. Starting first on WGN-TV at 9:14 Sunday night during a sportscast.
12 quarters finally did.
Take some pretty sophisticated microwave equipment operating in the broadcast auxiliary frequency bands and a significant amount of power.
About 2 hours later, the video pirate struck again. This time, the target was a science fiction broadcast on PBS affiliate WTTW. And this time, it wasn't 25 seconds long. It ran for almost a minute and a half. By this time, the pirate had managed to insert audio as well, along with a display of a marital aid and a portion of his or her anatomy. The incidents are now under investigation by the FCC and the FBI.
Did they ever find out what it was? It was just a technical error, was it?
It wasn't even an error. There was hoaxers, basically, who intercepted the signal on this PBS station.
Oh, I see. Right.
And it's very strange. You'll have to watch it. I've, like I said, links in the show notes.
And as ever, you'll find links for more information on almost everything that we discuss on the podcast at our show notes on our podcast blog, which you can find at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. Right, I think that's enough. Close the door, Hayden. Let's go back up. I think the voice is the best part of the routine, for which I thought it was Michael Spicer, who played Morbius.
Yes, it's that. I was going to say that.
But apparently it's just Colin Douglas again.
I thought it sounded like Morbius. That sort of that robotic gurgling. That's it.
That sort of thing, yeah.
You have condemned me!
It sounds like Sill.
This was Morbius.
The Time Lords will not oppose me again, nor the Sisterhood!
And this was the Rutan.
That is a lie!
Give the Foghorn another tug, will you, Mark? Pretend you're Leela having fun doing it. I do think the resolution was a little silly. Suitably dramatic and opposite to a lighthouse, but it's a little silly, I think. Mm. Oh, I've got a diamond, and I'll... And everyone dies, of course.
Yeah.
Except the Doctor and Leela, which is quite sad.
So we are... This is completely different, then, to the story that we reviewed last time, Fury from the Deep, where nobody dies. This is one when everyone dies.
In Fury from the Deep, no one died. But in Horror of Fang Rock, someone died. In fact, everyone died.
Yeah, and Leela and Doctor don't seem much troubled by it, do they, really?
No!
He's reciting a poem at the
Mine's
end.
Mine's the doctor of a poem you once knew. And and they have a little chuckle and stroll into the TARDIS.
You almost expect it to end on a chuckle cliffhanger like Police Squad.
But I suppose the main job they've done there is blowing up the mothership. So and therefore saving the whole of the Earth. I mean, the Doctor does do that sometimes, doesn't he? He just sort of... It feels like he's blind to human life sometimes. Especially, I think, this Doctor. You know, he's people die and that's just the way of it. He kind of doesn't get... Quite often, these people's deaths just seem to...
That's really interesting because it is... Do you remember that scene in... I can't remember which Christopher Eccleston episode it is. It might be Parting of the Ways, but when he's sort of reminded that after he's done whatever he does, saves the day and everything, and just disappears in his box again, there's collateral damage left behind, isn't there? That he doesn't tidy up, and then it can lead to disaster. And actually, funnily enough, the Fourth Doctor is the Doctor I think of, or thought of, sorry, when I've watched that in the past, you know. When all of a sudden it dawns on the Eccleston Doctor of, oh God, yeah, no, I do just leave and everything's a complete mess. And you think, well, although then again, I suppose, you know, he's disposed of any of the evidence, hasn't he? Like, everyone's blown up.
Linda with a Y or I?
That's tells it. Yeah, him we're just that talking
the,
about the
all the disaster began when he got rid of the Jagrafess.
Yes.
But it's all gone wrong. I mean, history's gone wrong again. This should be the fourth great and bountiful human empire. I don't understand. Last time I was here, I put it right.
No, but that's when it first went wrong. 100 years ago, like you said. All the news channels, they just shut down overnight.
But that was me. I did that.
There was nothing left in their place. No information. The whole planet just froze. The government, the economy, they collapsed. That was the start of it. 100 years of hell.
Oh, my.
What other little bits have we got? I love the line, all this is going on, and they go to the light lamp room and find the Doctor just giving Vince a potted history of lighthouses.
Yeah.
He talks about, they used to use slaves to keep the lighthouse going at the Pharos in Egypt, and Vince just says, oh, right, oh, well, I suppose it's different abroad. and then, unfortunately, the Doctor just gets interrupted as he's saying, and of course on Gallifrey, I'd have loved to hear what...
Oh, yes, the song Gallifrey.
Like, sorry, Gallifrey Lighthouses. It's all, of course, based on... I think this is where Robert Holmes got the idea. It's based on The Ballad of Flann and Isle by Wilfred Gibson. It's essentially happened in 1900 on the Flann and Islands in the Hebrides. Three lighthouse keepers disappeared without explanation. And when the supply ship turned up, it wasn't exactly that. You know, there was an open door and a ready-made meal on the table. But it was, I think they just assumed that they must have gone out to try to fix something. And they got all swept into the sea by a wave or something. And it's not only that, it's a Genesis song.
Oh, yeah.
The Mystery of Flann and Isle Lighthouse.
Genesis! Genesis allowed is not.
Flann and Isle is in the south by the point of Kerjuri, 47 miles from land in the roughest part of the sea. Oh, and the finest day of the sea is black. Oh, they say no one has ever come back from there.
It's not as catchy as Turn It On Again. But there you are. Which is ironic, because that's what they're trying to do with the light the whole time.
I think we're coming to a natural end anyway, aren't we?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I'm always doing that.
What, you're always coming to a natural end?
Yes.
No, I think it's about, from the Christmas I've said of Tom, which is more sort of, I don't think I'd have noticed it really unless there's this story that Louise has told several times about, you know, her tipping point with him. I think it's quite a tightly built and written and characterised drama. And I think although Paddy Russell doesn't seem to have been keen on the idea of all this tight angles I've got to do with this settings, I think that adds wonderfully to it. We have had several communications from our faithless, from the most faithful of our faithless listeners, to our plea for comments on it. Johnny Dab on Facebook says, horror is well scary, with cool, believable characters who all drive the plot very smoothly. Gets a 9 out of 10 from me. Well, I suppose that's a short way of doing what would take us about 2 hours to say. Michael Storm on Twitter, at Sandman Jazz, says he thinks that Terrence missed a trick of making it really claustrophobic by making it just the lighthouse crew, maybe having Harker as a fourth crew member. Despite its well-received view in fandom, I find it rather pedestrian, says Michael. The Toffs are not engaging and are just there to be Rutan fodder. Skinsale and Palmdale are uninteresting. Adelaine's an utter I think we'll agree at the start, and then becomes annoying rather than sympathetic. Oh, right, well,
wow.
That's exactly what the view that any of us had taken. I don't find it pedestrian at all.
No, I find it a very easy watch, like to watch all four episodes in one go. It seems to me to fairly fly by.
Oh, it does. Yeah, it does.
I don't think there's any point, you know, despite the fact that we're pretty much on either in the lighthouse or on the rocks outside, at no point do I feel bored.
No.
It doesn't seem to drag for me.
Absolutely not, no.
It pulls me along with it.
If it was any more than a four-parter, it would be seriously detrimental to the story.
Yes.
Yeah, oh, you can imagine this being a six-parter in the Pertwee era, for example.
Oh, God, yeah.
Right, well, I think we're drawing to a close. So while we're coming up with our marks out of 10, let's make our way down the spiral staircase to the foot of the lighthouse, shall we? Marks out of 10? I would give it an 8.
I'm with Johnny Dab. I'd give it a 9. I think it's a great episode.
I think I'm going to sandwich myself right between you two and put 8.5 because it's not... Well, it's one of the best Tom Baker stories, and I stand by this, I'm afraid. I think there's only one more classic Tom Baker story after this.
Nightmare of Eden.
Actually, I have to shut up.
What? What?
Actually, there's two. I retract that. There are two.
Oh, Horns and Nymon.
Tom Baker classics after that. You get out. Go on, go on, go and do what you need to do. Go on.
I totally agree.
I think this is a great story, and it's sort of at the start of a new era. But it's at the point where I think, as Doc alluded to earlier, I think where possibly the series start the quality starts to get a little varied after this.
Yeah,
it's a difficult season, isn't it? Season 15, I think.
It is, yeah. Yeah, it is. A difficult production as well, of course, as we've been saying. So it's a great story. 8.5. Yeah, 8.5.
Someone at the door.
Oh, no, it's not. What hull is it?
Oh, thank goodness it's only Uncle Terrence.
Ah.
Oh, do you know what? I couldn't see you out there. There was no light, you see. I had to Spider-Man shimmy up here, you know. It was terrible. Absolutely terrible. I've got wote burns, you see. I've got wote burns all over my hands. How am I going to explain this to the wife?
I'm afraid that everyone except the Doctor and Leela has died, Uncle Terence. Have you got any advice for us what we should do with these bodies?
Well, considering that very little of them will survive after that explosion, you see, I think that maybe the best thing to do is to not dump them in the river.
Uncle Terence, we have steam yachts crashing on the Deauville to Brighton line.
Oh, God, they seem to be Mark's P line by the looks of it. That's not good. Let's hope they don't sink. Oh, that's it. It's a trap.
Right. As we walk back over the rocks into town, let's see if we can collect any more money for... Have you got the effigy of Chris Chibnall on the go-kart, Mark? Okay. Just lock the door behind us. So, keep listening right to the end credits, listeners, because there'll be a making of this episode Easter egg for you right before the end credits. Okay. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye. Till next time.
Bye.
Remember, remember, 5th of November. treason should ever be forgot. And we'll come a copper golden, copper golden, copper golden, come a copper golden for bonfire night. Now down in your cellar, there's an album whenever there's doubt. On your Cornish bird out there, pepper pot, all until night. If you give us nout, we'll pinch nout and bid you good night. And we'll come a copper calling, copper calling, copper calling. We'll come a copper calling for bonfire night.
Thanks for staying with us this far, faithless listeners. As a treat for the most faithful of you, we're now including an Easter egg, because we know that you'll have nothing better than to find out how the Diddly Dum podcast is made behind the scenes. Enjoy. And we're going to have it introduced by a recording that we've managed to get hold of Terence Dix reading the prologue from his novelisation of the story. Let's just see if I can find the tape. Oh, here we are. Are you ready, Hayden?
Okay.
I'll just slip it in and press play.
The Legend of Fang Wok. Fang Wok Lighthouse, centre of a series of mysterious and terrifying events at the turn of the century, is built on a rocky island a few miles off the Channel coast. So small is the island that wherever you stand, its rocks are wet and seas... Oh. It's
That's such a tongue twister. Okay.
Each rocks are wet with sea spray. Everywhere you hear the endless thundering of the waves as they crash on the jagged coastline that has given Fang Wok its name. The lighthouse tower is in the centre of the island. A steep flight of steps leads up to the heavy door in its base, you see. This gives entry to the lower floor, where the big steam-driven generator throbs steadily away. Providing...
What?
Okay. Hayden, can you start from this gives entry again? Because when you said generator, you drop back into your own voice.
Okay, hang on. This is so difficult. Okay.
Gives entry to the lower floor where the big steam-driven generator throbs steadily away, providing power for the electric lantern. Coal bunkers occupy the west of this lower area, you see. Winding stairs lead up to the crew room, where the men eat, sleep, and spend most of their leisure time. Next to the crew room is a tiny kitchen. Above more storerooms and the head keeper's private cabin, and above them the service rooms, where tools and spare parts are kept, you see, together with rockets, macroons, mac...
macaroons.
Oh, God. Okay. Okay. Oh, I'm crying. Excuse me a minute. Okay. Yeah, dear. Christ. Okay. Oh, come on, Terence, where are you?
Together with rockets, maroons, flares, and a variety of other warning devices.
Finally. Oh, right, okay.
Finally, a short, steep iron stairway leads up into the lamp room, a glassed-in circular chamber at the very top of the tower, dominated by the giant carbon arch lamp with its gleaming glass prisms, you see. Fang Wok has had an evil reputation from its earliest days. Soon after it was built, two men died in mysterious circumstances, and a third went mad with fear. There have been strange rumours, stories of a great glowing beast that comes out of the sea. But all is forgotten now. It is from the early 1900s. And the age of science...
No. It is the early 1900s.
It is, sir. Yes, you are right, yes. It is the early 1900s, you see. And the age of science is in full swing. Newly converted from oil to electricity, Fang Wok Lighthouse stands tall and strong. Tall and strong. The great shining lantern warning ships away from the jagged reefs around the little island. As night falls, one fine autumn evening, the lamp is burning steadily. The three men who make up the crew go peacefully about their duties, unaware of the night of horror that lies before them, little knowing that they would soon be caught up in a strange and terrible conflict with the fate of the Earth itself as the final stake.
Oh, well done.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun,
around dun, the wagged weaves.
Christ.
Around the wagged weaves, the wagged rascal.
I was reading that in tears, most of that. I've never cried as Terence Dix before. Oh my God. That was so hard.
And there's something about the way you were reading it out, those last few lines, that made me think you're going to suddenly say, hewn into the living rock of Stonehenge.
Stonehenge, where the demons dwell. The demons
dwell, and the banshees live, and they do live well.
Oh, am I...
Sorry, what's this?
It's
Spinal Tap.
Oh, I'm not cool enough to understand that.
Well, it was a bit more concerned that we had a prop on stage which could be crushed by a dwarf.
How do we return to normality after that?
You have been listening to the Diddly Dun Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydunpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at Diddly Dun, on Twitter at diddly_dun, or email us at diddlydunpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dun, the empty space that circles time.